From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 36 for Friday, the 29th of July, 2011. On the show this week, we'll peel back the figurative eyelids on Northerners to ask the question, why are your eyeballs so big? We'll also wrestle an answer out of the BBC to find out why its global launch of iPlayer is restricted to Apple's iPad. And speaking of iPads, did Facebook accidentally leak its forthcoming iPad app? Here's a clue. Yes. All that and more coming up as we cruise our way through this week's reservoir of Wired news. Hey there, I'm Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me in Condé Nast's cryogenic chamber is senior staff writer Duncan Gear.
Greetings.
And associate editor Olivia underscore and proud Solan.
Hello.
How are we doing?
Very well, thank you.
I have noticed something in the trinket cupboard this week. We have some kind of preserving sugar on the table. What is preserving sugar?
It has a larger grain than regular sugar to make a clear syrup when you melt it, allegedly.
Someone's been reading the side of the pack.
Yes, I have.
I don't understand this. That's not on the list of topics for discussion in today's show, but we do have quite a feature-packed one anyway. Later on, we're going to speak to Michael Breidenbrucker, who is the founder, I believe, of RJDJ, second part of our sort of Focus on the Future of Music series that we started last week without planning it on being a series in the first instance. We
basically just ran out of time. And
we had Moby on 2 weeks ago. We had Imogen Heap last week. And then this week we've got one of the co-founders of Last.fm and now founder of RJDJ.
Correct.
So kind of a music-centric promise. No more music next week. That's coming up later. First, we're going to talk about the High Court having some shenanigans, Duncan, with BT.
That's correct. The High Court has ordered BT to block access to what is essentially a search engine for content on newsgroups called Newsbin2.
And so these newsgroups are places where people can talk and leave messages, but also they are kind of used a lot for posting copyrighted material for other people to download.
That's like a
precursor to BitTorrent that's still around.
Yeah, I mean, they date from way, way, way before an awful lot of the internet existed. And they have kind of stuck around since quietly and act as a kind of alternate web to the regular web. And people discovered towards the start of this decade that they're actually quite a good place for sharing content.
They're quite a good place. And unfortunately for BT customers using that good place, the High Court has said, you have to stop doing this. And they've done it in quite an interesting way.
Yeah, well, they've ordered BT to use the technology that it uses to block child porn at a DNS level. They're using that technology to block copyrighted content.
So is this putting the sort of illegitimate downloads of copyrighted material in the same category as child abuse images?
Essentially, yes.
This seems kind of wrong.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, this is a copyright dispute, essentially. This should not be on the same level as that kind of thing.
So the site itself doesn't actually host any content. It's basically, they describe themselves as the Google for Usenet.
Correct.
So it's exactly the same way as the Pirate Bay. Could we see sites like the Pirate Bay taken down for the same reasons?
There's a strong possibility now that this precedent has been set that content owners will use this this court case to force other ISPs to force other to block other access to other sites. I think it's very, very dangerous because putting more attention on these filters that are currently being used to block child porn, if you use them to block copyrighted content, that's something that people will want to get around much more than they're going to want to get around filters to block child abuse. And so if you've got a situation where people are trying to defeat these filters, it makes it much, much easier for people creating child porn to hide.
But I don't think that it's, when we talk about it kind of being bundled together with child porn, it's not like they're saying that this is as bad as child pornography. It's just there is this mechanism through which you can block a website and they're using the same mechanism to do it. I think it's a bit of a leap to then say that they're taking it as seriously as child pornography. It just that isn't an alternative.
I mean, to be honest, it's kind of ridiculous using censorship to try and defeat these problems totally. It just drives them further underground, in both situations.
It is, but I think they've got to be seen to being something to protect copyright laws. And, you know, this might not be the right way, but I think they have to do something, or at least try to do something, carrot and stick.
But why just BT?
I mean, that's
just
strange.
BT's users. I mean, BT is one of the biggest ISPs. That's obviously part of the reason. But why not make everyone? Why not block Virgin Media, block TalkTalk, block Tiscali, all these people?
But I guess by doing the largest, you then create fear amongst all the other ones who don't want to get into an expensive legal case and so might then self-regulate. But which this is even more worrying.
But this is daft. You should be making all of these people self-regulate. I mean, all you're doing here is saying, if you access this site, don't sign up with BT. Go with Virgin Media, who won't be blocking this, at least not yet.
And also, the biggest problem with this is there's no real good legal alternatives when it comes to movie content and TV content.
Yeah. Well, I think you could dispute that now. I mean, you may not want to buy from iTunes, you may not want to rent from Amazon or whatever, but we do have more choices than ever before.
Yeah, but it's still not anywhere near as comprehensive as it is in, say, the world of music.
I want an ad-funded model where I can watch movies for free online.
You want Spotify for music, don't
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
For movies. But the thing is, it hasn't had long enough to mature yet. I mean, one of the reasons
That's rubbish.
No, it isn't rubbish. Music was more easily able to advance because the files were smaller at a time when broadband wasn't as everywhere as it is now.
But the movie and the TV industry should have learnt from the mistakes that the music industry has made, and they singularly have not done that.
They should. You're absolutely right. But it does take quite a while to sort of move agreements and to get everyone signed up and to make sure that one person doesn't have the same sort of monopolistic control over like iTunes did for the majority of the time that music services like this were kicking off. Anyway, we've gone a little bit off topic, but if you have a view on this, podcast@wired.co.uk, let us know, particularly if you're a BT customer who is particularly pissed off. We will read out your emails. Last week, we talked about Apple stores in China that were illegitimate, unauthorized, and very convincing that the former two reasons were not... You know where I'm going with this.
I do.
Anyway, they've been closed down.
They have, yeah. There was about five unauthorized stores in China, in the Kunming area. And following the news that they'd been kind of discovered, there was an official investigation by the Chinese government, and they found that all the stores were obviously fake, and that but they were selling real Apple products. However, because two of the stores didn't have licenses to sell stuff, they got closed down. But three of them are going to remain because they have bought all their products through legitimate sources.
So what we're seeing here basically is that the Chinese government investigated and said, well, you're selling official Apple products and you're buying them from other authorized resellers.
And you've got a business permit.
Yeah, it's just weird how they can close a couple of them down but say, well, you're unauthorized and you're breaking the rules, whatever.
Well, the two that were closed down didn't have official business permits. They weren't authorized to sell products in Kunming at all.
Yeah.
And that's why they got closed down. The Chinese government is now investigating whether Apple has applied to have its store design and its layout protected by law in China. And that investigation is still ongoing.
We will follow the story. But it's good to know at least that the products people were buying were legitimate.
Is it?
Well, yeah. Some people were going into the store and sort of asking, are my products legit? I've seen that your store's dodgy. So it's a good move to at least confirm that they were real products.
But not good for makers of counterfeit Apple products.
Well, that's true. Moving on. Duncan, last week we spoke, about iPlayer going global?
I think it was
a few weeks ago. Mm.
In a previous show, we talked about the iPlayer going global and people have to pay for it to access about 1,500 hours of content.
This is people outside of Britain. We'll still get it for free.
It's launched.
It has launched. It is now available in Western Europe in 11 countries, and it's going to be coming to the United States and Australia and Canada later this year.
So people outside of the UK but still in Europe. So what's France, Spain,
Germany? Do you want
Germany,
the full list?
Some of those great countries that we love so
Switzerland's
dearly.
Switzerland's in there and Luxembourg.
Oh, you've got to remember Luxembourg.
They can now pay for iPlayer. This is pretty good, right?
It is good. It pushes more of the BBC's fantastic content out further around the world, and it lets the BBC make money in a way that isn't funded by the licence fee, and so they get to do more stuff without having to deal with the government on it.
You sounded like you've been paid by BBC there to say that.
I haven't, no.
That was very good marketing.
I'm a fan of the BBC. I think what it does is really, really good, and I've seen other news organisations and media organisations around the world, and I think the BBC is one of the best.
Well, we put you in a box.
I'm proud of it.
And stuck a stamp on you and sent you to BBC HQ to go and have a chat with Mark Smith, who I believe is the iPlayer's global launch director.
Correct.
And Luke Bradley-Jones, who's the MD of BBC.com. What did you ask them?
I asked them why it's going to be only available on the iPad.
Right, let's find out an answer.
I'm here with Mark Smith, who's the launch director for Global iPlayer, and Luke Bradley-Jones, who's the managing director of BBC.com. And we're here to talk about the global launch of the iPlayer. Could you first of all tell me a little bit about how the iPlayer that everybody else in the world gets is going to differ from the iPlayer that we get in the UK?
The global version of the iPlayer is going to be different in three very important ways. First of all, it's not a catch-up service, and it's not organised around our UK linear channels for obvious reasons, because most international audiences don't get those channels. And so we're going to launch with around 1,500 hours, but that'll be a mix of recent brand new Zeitgeist content, but also the very best of our content from our catalogue, whether that's comedy or natural history or drama. The second way it's very different is the core product. So although some of the core functionality is the same, the content set and some of the functionality and some is different, and so we've built a completely separate product, and I'll let Mark talk about that a little bit more in a second. And the third way is obviously there's a commercial service. So here in the UK, you get full access to the iPlayer as part of your license fee. Internationally, it's going to be a subscription service. We're launching with an all-you-can-eat single price point of €6.99 a month to have access to all the content on the service, or £49.99 a year for an annual subscription.
So as Luke said earlier, I think the service will be on the iPad only from day one. I think one of the key features in the product that we're really proud of is the fact, as well as being a streaming service, so if you have a Wi-Fi connection or 3G, you'll be able to stream content, but you'll also be able to download content to the actual device as well, so you can watch content when you're offline as well.
Why did you decide to go for an iPad-only release to start with? Why not other platforms as well?
Well, we hope in time that this service can be something which is widely distributed across multiple devices and platforms and multiple territories. But obviously, we're trying to build a business here, so this is a completely commercially funded service that has to stack up from a financial and commercial point of view. And we decided to run an initial phase, or a pilot phase, which is what we're calling it, for 12 months, focused just on one platform, and that's the iPad or the Apple iOS. And that allowed us just to focus our resources on building a service that was really compelling and easy to use and exciting, for one device. And we chose the iPad for two or three reasons. First of all, we think it's a great video device, and this was something we were taking a call on last summer or so, a year ago, and I think a lot of things have proven that to be true since then. Second of all, we have a great relationship with Apple, so we work very closely with them for all of our iTunes content. And a third, we decided that just initially we would like to use a billing platform that already existed and had users signed up to it and with all of their data and billing information already provided, so we're just a click away from allowing people to pay for this service rather than set up a whole new authentication process, and Apple obviously provides that to its users.
I understand there's also a kind of sponsored free trial almost.
So the app will be free to download from the App Store, and there will be some sample content that's available. So there'll be a free section that allows you to watch probably 10 hours maybe of long-form content, but also some short-form content as well in the forms of clips and trailers. So it's really, kind of teasers to get people, kind of interested and give them more information about the content that will be available.
I imagine that this is something that UK users will want to have access to on holiday. Is that possible?
On day one for launch this week, that's not going to be available to UK users, but that's something we're working on because we believe that a lot of UK users would love to be able to buy this service, whether it's to go on holiday with, or if you travel frequently for work, offering a service which gives the best of our content from across the years, it is something that we believe a lot of people in this market would be interested in using and paying for. So watch this space.
I guess by the time people hear this, it's going to be available in 11 countries across Western Europe. What are your plans for a wider rollout, particularly with regards to the States and maybe other Commonwealth territories around the world?
So we launched this week in those 11 markets in Western Europe, as you mentioned. We are aiming to launch the service in US and Canada in the fourth quarter of this year. And likewise for Australia as the other target market we have for this pilot phase.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Interviewed like a pro there, Duncan. Like
Thank
a
you.
Pro.
Thank you very much.
It's almost as if you get paid to do this. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we can come back, we're going to talk about the aforementioned giant eyeballs of Northerners.
Registration for the Wired 2011 Summit is now open. Don't miss your chance to hear some of the most inspiring talks from thought leaders of the wired world over 2 days this October in London. For more information, please visit wiredevent.co.uk.
Balls of eye. Eyeballs live. We had an interesting story on the site this week from Mark Brown, one of our daily news contributors.
We did.
Tell me, why is it that Northerners have massive eyeballs?
Well, it's not just massive eyeballs, as you call them, it's also larger brains. And this was a discovery made by anthropologists at Oxford University, who collected around, I think it was 55 skulls dating from the 1800s from all different populations around the globe. And what they discovered was as you go and went north, up from the equator, the size of the eyes and the brains got larger. And, you know, some people are saying, oh, it's because, you know, people are clever and everyone's having a lot of banter on Twitter about this. But it's actually to process better vision for in the lower light areas of the world.
So the fact that their brains are bigger doesn't actually mean they're smarter. It just means that they have bigger image processing.
Yeah, which is obviously areas. Takes up a lot of the RAM of a brain is in image processing.
Now, I used to live near Manchester and it's not very dark.
It's not about north of England, Nate.
Okay. You see, when I hear Northerner, I think Manchester, I think, you know, Piccadilly.
We're talking the true Northerners here, from the Nordics, from Scandinavia, from Canada.
Exactly. So we're talking north within the hemisphere of the north.
So the argument that people have been having on our website about, oh, you're from London, that means you're stupider and have smaller eyes than us, that's actually relevant, because really what we're talking about here is the difference between the people in the equatorial regions versus people in Iceland.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's just people who don't need to let quite so much light into their eyes than those in the north.
Does this have massive ramifications? Are we going to be changing the way we think about eyes and brains and the size of the aforementioned?
Well, it's going to have implications for being able to track how the populations have moved around the world over time. If you find a particular group of people who've got very small eyes in the north, it indicates that they've arrived relatively recently on, you know, evolutionary timescales and vice versa.
And so maybe similarly, people with much larger eyes may have moved up from warmer regions and migrated north.
Other way around.
Sorry, of course, moved the other way around. Larger eyes have moved down to maybe warmer temperatures.
Where they probably get burnt retinas because their eyes were letting in too much light.
Interesting. I wonder if this would be true of other species on Earth, not just human beings.
It is. Well, there's definitely been studies shown between eye size and light levels. Birds with bigger eyes are generally the first to sing at dawn in low light conditions. And primates with larger eyes are the ones that eat and forage at nighttime.
Yeah, you've all seen those bush babies, those amazing, just all eyes, no head creatures.
I know there are types of crab that sort of exist in caves where there is absolutely no light. And they're basically blind.
Oh, okay. Well, they've gone completely the other way. They've decided that eyes are rendered redundant there.
Exactly.
And that as such, don't have them at all.
You can have a lot of fun with eyes.
You can.
A lot of fun.
My little sister used to collect prawn eyes when she ate prawns. She used to put them into a little butter packet for my mum to discover later.
Your sister?
My younger sister, yeah. Callie, if she's listening.
I'm thinking about boxes of eyeballs now.
Well, it's butter packets filled with eyeballs.
How about I talk about cryonics instead?
I think that would be the most amazing idea since the invention of loaves of bread and knives.
I think it's a bit of a sad story, really. Robert Ettinger, the founder of the cryonics movement, has died, aged 92.
That's not sad. He's 92.
And obviously his body has now been frozen.
So he died at his home in Michigan in the US, and his body was cryopreserved at the Cryonics Institute over there, naturally. I think it would be a bit wrong for him to turn around at 91 3/4 and say, you know what, I don't want to be frozen when I die.
Yeah, I'll go for cremation.
But he joins quite a collection of frozen dead people, doesn't he?
Absolutely. 105 people have been frozen in the facility already, including his mother and his two wives. But his father and brother refused to be frozen.
Now, when I first read that, I kind of assumed that they refused to be frozen because they were still alive. But I imagine his father had probably already passed
on. And if he's 92, yes, I think there's a good chance of that. He got interested in cryonics technology originally after getting seriously injured in the Second World War. He had bone graft surgery, which was a very early technique at the time. And it sparked a kind of interest in future medical technology for him. And then in 64, he penned The Prospect of Immortality, which advocated the cryonics thesis.
And 12 years later, I think, about 75, 76, he founded this Cryonics Institute in which he is now frozen.
Yes, which stores patients in liquid nitrogen at 320 degrees C below zero.
You see, I kind of want to do this, but it's really hard to review being dead and frozen.
It's pretty expensive as well.
Yeah, £28,000, I think, to go through the entire
dollars,
process.
Yes.
Dollars, yeah. I think I would have to be flushed into space. I think that is definitely the way that I would like to be preserved.
Also
eternally.
Quite an expensive way to go.
Yeah.
Can't you just settle for being burnt or buried like anyone else?
I just think I need something more dramatic.
I think
need to go out with quite literally a bang in space, like in a nebula. I want to become a nebula.
What about having a sky burial where you get eaten by vultures?
No, I'm quite into that idea.
I just don't want to become food. I would like to become...
You'll become worm food.
I don't know. I just think sometime in the future, in the next 60 years, I could be blown up in such a way that you could see it in daylight. I just think that'd be so cool. Anyway... That's the last of our news items for this week.
No, it's not.
No, it's not.
Except that it isn't, because we are also going to talk about bioart, which is sort of related to this in a kind of weird way.
Yeah.
Liv, you wrote this amazing feature that isn't necessarily news as such, but we really wanted to touch upon this movement because we've had a few stories on the site recently about bioart, which is about using human tissue in art, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, just as you can donate your organs for transplant purposes, you can also donate your tissues to be used, well, by either scientific, for scientific pursuits, but also for art. And there's a kind of new wave of artists who are using living human tissues or biological, bacteria and biological structures as their artistic medium.
Is this something you could do after you die then? I mean, instead of, if I decided not to be frozen or become a nebula,
yeah,
could I be turned into an art?
You could. I'm not sure if you can specify that you will only be used in art, but you can certainly say that you will give your body over for use in research and art purposes.
So why is this coming up now? I mean, is there anything particular that's going on right now?
Well, there's a gallery which has got a big exhibition in London at the moment called GV Art, which has currently got a show with some of the bioart pieces. But there's a kind of discussion about they are keen to get an actual laboratory within the gallery so that they can have bioreactors and show little living tissue sculptures growing in situ.
That's pretty amazing. I think we've got details of this on the website at the moment.
We do. But I think one of the most interesting things is the kind of ethical issues that this raises. I mean,
Have there been people picketing outside the gallery or anything?
Not at the moment, no. And this particular exhibition doesn't have any of the live tissues. It has some dry tissues that were formerly grown.
Oh.
But the thing is, when you're showing stuff that has live tissues, it's growing in bioreactors, how do you dispose of it at the end of the exhibition? You can't put it back into the lab because it's already kind of left the lab. It's been kind of officially contaminated. So they have this interesting kind of debate that a company called Symbiotica provokes when they have their pieces grown in exhibitions. And they have a kind of killing ritual where they take these little pieces out and get the audience members and curators to kind of, I guess, be complicit in the killing of this semi-living structure.
It sounds a bit ritualistic to me.
It is, but it's really interesting in terms of generating debate around things like stem cell research and bioengineering that are all things that are often done hidden away in labs. And I think it's a great way to kind of get people to understand it better and not see it as this kind of freaky Frankenstein process that it's been sensationalised as.
Well, for anyone who does want to understand it better, you've got a fab feature on the site that went up yesterday. If anyone wants to check it out, wired.co.uk, search for bio art, all one word, and you'll find it. It's a pretty in-depth piece and covers, I think, everything you need to know about the bio art.
Bio art 101.
And on that note, we're going to conclude the news and move on to our main feature for this week. So last week we had Imogen Heap and we also had Paul Smanitsky talking about music and, more importantly, the future of it. This week, Duncan, we're going to hear your interview with Michael Breidenbrucker.
That's right.
Tell me who he is.
He is the founder of a company called Reality Jockey, who have a bit of software called RJ DJ that lets you make really interesting, really creative mobile music apps.
Well, you spoke to him at our Wired Future of Music event the other day, and for what I recall, he was quite the interesting chap.
I'm here with Michael Breidenbrucker from Reality Jockey. Michael, first of all, can you tell us a little bit about what you do at Reality Jockey?
We think that with the iPhone, iPod, iPad, basically, if you look at those devices, it's like the new generation of Walkmans, and we call them smart music players. And what we do is we make the new technology on these smart music players available to musicians and producers, and we're creating new music formats and new music ideas and publish them in the App Store. The Walkman was just the Walkman, but now on the iPod and iPad and so on, we have access to a clock. What does that mean to music? And if you think about it, you create a song, but really that song could sound different in the morning than it sounds in the evening. Or we actually know the weather of your location, so we can create the song that sounds different when it's raining than when the sun is shining. But also we can do stuff like we can access the microphone of your device and just sample the percussive sounds around you and integrate them into the rhythmical structure of your music, of your sound, which makes the music you're listening to a very, very immersive thing, because your surrounding and this sort of virtual place you're in when you're listening to music becomes one thing. And that's really new to music.
So it's basically about turning albums into apps. Is that fair?
Yeah, well, if you think of an album as a creative piece where the artist is sort of tackling a specific topic and thinks about, you know, how to bring that topic alive in an album, then certainly that's what we're doing with apps. Like, for example, what we have done with Inception, the app. We took the topic and this, the idea and the story of Inception, the movie, and created an app out of it based on the soundtrack. And I think what the result is a really, really immersive musical experience.
And a lot of the work you've done so far has been tied to, I guess, releases of other physical products. So it's more marketing around the release of an album or a film than an actual creative object in itself. Can you see that changing in the future, or is it still going to maintain more of a secondary status? Mm-hmm.
So actually, that's exactly what we did not do. We always saw the platform, so the you know, smart music players, as a creative tool. So what we did is we really created, you know, creative pieces which are tailored to these platforms. If you think about artist apps, there is a lot of artist apps out there which are basically just bundling stuff that is on the internet currently, like videos and some interviews and whatever, pictures and some, you know, 30-second tracks and stuff like that. So those artist apps, that is what I would call a sort of marketing thing. But what we tried to do all the time was really create real creative pieces.
So RJDJ does an awful lot of things, but what can't it yet do that you'd love to see it be able to do?
You know, RJDJ is made possible because of two things. One, because we have hardware out there in the consumer's hands that, you know, if you compare that hardware to what was on the market like 10, 20, 30 years ago, it's a sound studio. So it's the first time you have this kind of music, this kind of technology in consumers' hands, which is great. The other thing is that we have seen a lot of advances in how in music, in sound synthesis. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, great synthesizers, great samplers, sequencers, effects, all of that stuff. So music technology as a whole made a big, 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 you know, step forward in the last 10, 20 years. And that's really what we're utilizing now and making accessible for the end user. But what we don't have yet is actually sound recognition, so that machines understand what kind of sound is what's happening around them musically. And that's something that I think is a very, very interesting research topic at the moment. And those those results, we will be able to utilize creatively. You know, for example, for us, it's not about speech recognition, understanding what is this, you know, that the machine actually understand what am I talking. But for us, it's about just understanding, is this person talking or not? Because if you have that information, you know, musically, you can create very, very great experiences.
Okay, and finally, there are some people out there who are going to see this as the work that you guys do as a, I guess, a bit of a gimmick, something that almost detracts from the music itself. How do you get around that? How do you get people to actually listen to the music rather than just look at the technology?
You're right. A lot of people see it like that, or not a lot, but some people see it like that. Because for them, you know, the perfect piece of music is really someone playing on the guitar and singing live to it. Which is fair enough, you know, that's true. But what we think, and I think there's a growing number of people who think like us, is that actually, you know, if you just apply specific effects to the live microphone signal, you can do a lot. I mean, we've just listened to this live performance of Imogen, and I mean, what she was doing, a lot of what she was doing was just applying 2-3 filters and effects on her voice. And that was supersonic interesting. And this is a new art form, and it's also something that musicians and producers are embracing a lot. And I think we will see a lot of really, really amazing artistic and creative results based on these new techniques. Just for an example, a guy called Roman Heffeli from Switzerland, he was using our platform to develop something which was called the World Quantizer. And what the World Quantizer does is it's just listening for percussive sounds around you and then integrates them into the rhythmic structure of a song. The effect of it is super amazing because everything around you is all of a sudden synced to the music you're listening to. And this is sort of a musical technology piece it's a technology that hasn't been there before, but is now becoming available, and actually it's becoming available to the end user, and it's amazing. It sounds great, and it's, yeah, as I said, piece of art. It's not just, you know, annoying things.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. And I think that finally concludes our three-part unplanned, unexpected series of music features for our podcast.
We'll give you a break over the next few weeks.
You're all very, very welcome. And in fact, that's the last thing we're going to talk about, with the exception that Imogen Heap, if you want to see a video of her and her amazing gloves that we talked about last week, if you go to wired.co.uk and search for Imogen Heap, you will find a link to the video. Duncan, tell people how they can get in touch with us.
You can also follow us on Twitter. We are Twitter. We are at Wired UK. And you can also get in touch with us on Facebook. We are facebook.com/WiredUK or email us podcast@wired.co.uk.
And you should email us. We love getting email, particularly if it's from you. Yes, you. Anyway, and on that note, until next week, be excellent to each other.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Liv, are you writing anything relevant?
No, I'm just drawing a horse.
He looks delicious.
Yeah, he does. There he is.
That's quite good.
Can we get a picture up on the...
I can do a better one. No, that's not my best. Like, this is my special skill, is drawing horses.
Can we give it away as a prize?
Yeah.
Should we give it away as a prize?
Yeah.
Okay, anyone who hears this, email podcast@wired.co.uk.
First person.
And the first person to email in.
In the UK, we should probably say.
We'll get a picture of Percy the horse.
Yeah, we'll send this original that we'll take a photo of.
Okay.